It is Monday, April 15th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith's 32nd season of entertainment presents the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Symphonic Band tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Fort Smith Convention Center. This performance will feature Sousa marches and symphonic hymns and most everything in between, including music of artistic and historical significance. Tickets and more information available at uafs.edu. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, how states like Arkansas are handling greenhouse gas emission standards, plus the hundreds of volunteers and thousands of hours of preparation for the Coleman races in Rogers this month are stepping into high gear right about now. Plus, a nearly forgotten blues musician from Logan County, West Virginia. That's explained later. First, the vote on a bill that would let the state implement a plan to provide private health insurance with federal Medicaid dollars is expected to happen this afternoon. Lawmakers asked legislative leaders to postpone the vote so they could better explain it to their constituents over the weekend. Speaker of the House, Davy Carter, made the announcement Friday.
This is something fundamentally different than the, quote, Obamacare, end quote, that we've been talking about for so many years. And everybody has to get their arms around what the two choices are. I mean, they're real, effects of both decisions. And, I think it was a reasonable request, and we'll circle back up on Monday.
A bill laying out the state's plan to use money in the Affordable Care Act for private insurance for Arkansans, making up to 138% of the federal poverty level, has passed the Senate and House with simple majorities. The budget bill for the plan will need a separate vote and a 75% supermajority in both chambers. Speaking against the plan late last week, several lawmakers indicated they are for it but are voting against it because it's what their constituents want them to do. In Little Rock this weekend, former presidential candidate John McCain called President Obama's reaction to tensions in Syria shameful and a classic example of a failure of American leadership. Senator McCain was invited to speak at the Robinson Center by the Clinton School of Public Service. He said the president ignored the advice of his entire national security team when things began heating up in Syria.
Every one of them recommended giving arms to the freedom fighters in Syria. Every one of them. They were overruled at the White House. Now we announced yesterday we're going to get them flak jackets. I'm sure that that's of great comfort to these fighters while the Scud missiles are exploding. It's just shameful.
Senator McCain said more than 80,000 Syrians have been massacred by the regime of the dictator Bashar Assad. The senator, who lost a bid for the presidency to the president in 2008, said it was not his intention to bash the president because he is trying to work with him on immigration reform as well as other legislation. Some changes are coming to certain child welfare programs in Arkansas. The state recently received a waiver from the federal government through the Adoption and Safe Families Act that allows the state more flexibility in child welfare practices over a five-year period. Governor Mike Beebe says the flexibility allows child welfare workers to respond in new ways to lower-risk child maltreatment scenarios, which can include circumstances of inadequate food, clothing, and shelter, inadequate supervision, and unhealthy living conditions.
In one recent example, a family was referred to the state for the poor living conditions of the children. They'd been wearing the same clothes for multiple days, did not smell clean, and were living in a cluttered, roach-ridden home. In the past, this would have triggered an investigation that meant months of involvement between state officials and the family. Instead, the state referred the family to a community assistance program that supplied the children with food and clean socks. The family received a donated bug sprayer so they could address their pest problems themselves. The information and support from the state allowed the family to become more engaged in caring for their children without court or protective services intervention.
The governor says the new approach focuses on assistance and community involvement rather than an adversarial investigative approach. He says that the new flexibility can safely reduce the number of children entering foster care in the state. The Arkansas baseball team travels to Nebraska for two games in the middle of this week. After dropping 2 of 3 to LSU and Fayetteville this weekend, the Razorbacks lost the rubber game of the three-game series yesterday, 5-3 in 10 innings. Arkansas will play in Lincoln, Nebraska tomorrow night and Wednesday afternoon before returning to Fayetteville for a three-game set this weekend against Texas A&M. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals had a tough time this weekend. The team did get its first two wins of the season last week, but the Nats dropped two of three games over the weekend to the Midland Rockhounds. All told, the Naturals now 3-7 on the Young Texas League season. Since the first of the year, Northwest Arkansas has received 12.5 inches of rain. That's according to data from Drake Field collected by the National Weather Service. The total is nearly an inch higher than average and almost a full 3 inches higher than the year-to-date precipitation of this time last year. With all the rain, lake levels that were diminished by drought over the past 2 years are making a recovery. According to the most recent numbers released by the Army Corps of Engineers, Beaver Lake registered at 1,117.2 feet above mean sea level, just more than 3 feet below the seasonal average. Table Rock Lake in Missouri is even closer to its seasonal average, registering at nearly 914.5 feet. That's just shy of the average of 915 feet. The spring weather and higher lake levels expected to bring more people to area lakes. Lori Driver is a spokesperson with the Army Corps of Engineers. She says many are drawn to the lakes for recreation in the spring, and they should keep safety in mind.
Anytime visitors go to the lake to recreate, they need to take into account if they're in a boat, boating safely, don't drink alcohol, be careful of other people, but particularly the beginning of the recreation season. Folks haven't been out all year, may be a little rusty with their boat handling. Be careful of folks in the water. Be careful of obstructions in the water. Either the lake is high or it's low. There may be something under the water that they don't remember from the year before. Be courteous of other folks. Have a great time. Enjoy the lake, but be water safe at every time.
Aside from slim chances of rain, the weather for the next few days should be agreeable for some time on the lake. Tonight, 30% chance of thunderstorms, a low in the upper 50s in northwest Arkansas. Clouds with lows in the mid-60s in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy. Highs will range from 77 to 82. And tomorrow night, cloudy, 30% chance of showers after midnight. Lows tomorrow in the lower 60s throughout the listening area. This is Ozarks at Large. Concern over the long-term effects of greenhouse gas emissions has led to changes in standards, and states like Arkansas are now paying more attention to make sure that the regulations set out in the Clean Air Act are met. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has this report.
It just makes more sense for state governments to take the lead in implementing the federal Clean Air Act. That's the view of the Environmental Protection Agency, anyway. But the comprehensive law that governs different types and sources of emissions, which was originally passed in 1970 and amended heavily in 1990, didn't include regulations for greenhouse gases until recent years. Jenna Durant is a spokesperson for the EPA's Region 6 office.
States have long been the permitting authority for different types of air permits. So it's just natural that they would continue to be the authority for GHG permits as well. And we also want facilities who are subject to these permits to be able to go basically to a one-stop shop and get all of their permits in one place.
The regulation of greenhouse gas emissions from light-duty road vehicles came in 2009 after the EPA first issued its findings that elevated levels of the six common greenhouse gases pose a threat to the general health and welfare of current and future generations. Shortly thereafter, the EPA issued regulations regarding not only road vehicles, but stationary sources of greenhouse gases as well. At first, major generators of greenhouse gases, such as coal-fired power plants or steel mills, had to apply for permits from both the EPA and the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality as well. But starting this month, that process has changed.
EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gases really started with the Supreme Court's decision in 2007 called Massachusetts versus EPA, which determined that greenhouse gases were an air pollutant that needed to be regulated under the Clean Air Act. So it was mostly just a question of programs already being in place, that the first step for greenhouse gas regulation was for light-duty vehicles. And then following that came permitting facilities under Title V of the Clean Air Act.
As a result of the EPA's desire to send emissions permit applicants to a so-called one-stop shop, the ADEQ worked closely with the federal administration to develop a state implementation program that would fall in line with national ambient air quality standards. Arkansas is contained in the EPA's Region 6, which also includes Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and New Mexico. Arkansas is the first state in the region to develop its own program for issuing permits for greenhouse gas emissions. Catherine Beninati is a spokesperson with the ADEQ.
We wanted to streamline the process. And in 2002, EPA issued a determination. Once they published their final greenhouse gas rule in 2010, they issued a determination that deemed our state implementation plan and regulation was inadequate compared to their federal regulations. And we were in good company. About a dozen states, including Arkansas, were required to make changes to their own air pollution regulations.
So who has to apply for greenhouse gas permits in Arkansas? To understand that question, one must also understand the meaning of carbon dioxide equivalent emissions, a value that is found by taking the emitted mass of each greenhouse gas and multiplying it by the gas's predetermined global warming potential. Those individual products are then summed to get the carbon dioxide equivalent emissions. Beninati says that under the greenhouse gas regulations, an emissions permit is required for new construction of facilities that could potentially generate at least 100,000 tons per year of CO2 equivalent emissions. But the regulations also apply to major modifications of existing facilities.
A major modification is considered an increase of 75,000 tons per year of CO2 equivalent. So these are the biggest of the big. We don't really permit by industry. We're permitting by pollutant. So we don't see a whole lot of these cases. But there are three permits in-house that would be affected, and one of those is Big River Steel.
In its application to the ADEQ for an air quality permit, known as a Prevention of Significant Deterioration Permit, Big River Steel estimated that its proposed facility in Osceola could potentially produce more than 243,000 tons of CO2 equivalent emissions per year. Durant says that the permitting threshold for greenhouse gases is allowed to be much higher than that of other air pollutants for a simple reason.
Greenhouse gases were subject to what was called the tailoring rule in the Clean Air Act, and the tailoring rule bumped up the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that facilities were allowed to produce. So in other words, it takes a larger amount of GHGs for a facility to be permitted than it does, say, a more toxic emission like lead.
Under the Clean Air Act, criteria pollutants such as lead, sulfur dioxide, or ground-level ozone are subject to permitting thresholds of only 100 or 250 tons emitted per year. But the tailoring rule has done more besides raising the permitting threshold for greenhouse gases. It has also allowed the EPA to phase in permitting processes for greenhouse gases. But that's not all. A 2010 EPA chart compares potential greenhouse gas permitting burdens with and without use of the Clean Air Act's tailoring rule. According to the chart, 82,000 permitting actions would have been necessary to address greenhouse gases each year, with an annual cost of $1.5 billion to permitting agencies if the rule wasn't used. But with the tailoring rule, the EPA projected that only 1,600 permitting actions would be needed annually, with a cost of $36 million to permitting authorities. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
While the Arkansas House continued to ponder a possible expanded Medicaid for Arkansas late last week, putting off a vote until at least today, other political and business items made the news the past 7 days. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has his regular Monday roundup of the week that was.
Bank of the Ozarks announced net income for the quarter ended March 31st was $20 million, an 11% increase from $18 million for the first quarter of 2012. During the fourth quarter of 2012, Little Rock-based Bank of the Ozarks completed its acquisition of a bank in Alabama. J.B. Hunt Transport Services reported first quarter net income of $73.3 million. That was up from $67.7 million 1 year ago. The Lowell-based trucking and transportation giant reported higher quarterly operating revenue of $1.29 billion. Springdale-based George's Inc., one of the nation's largest privately held poultry companies, announced Carl George and Charles George as co-CEOs and co-presidents, effective April 5th. Previous CEO and President Gary George will continue as the company's chairman. Attorney General Dustin McDaniel got what he asked for, and then some, from ExxonMobil in the wake of a major pipeline oil spill that occurred near Mayflower about 2 weeks ago. McDaniel set an April 10th deadline for the oil behemoth to comply with his subpoena for documents. The company provided nearly 13,000 pages of information to McDaniel's office. McDaniel also asked ExxonMobil for $4 million to establish a fund to pay for the state's investigative expenses. Entergy Arkansas says it has received final regulatory approval from the Arkansas Public Service Commission in its move to join the Midwest Independent System Operation Transmission Group, also known as MISO. Entergy began its effort to decouple itself from a transmission system agreement with its parent company and subsidiaries after a 2005 ruling forced the electric utility to absorb costs from sister organizations in the region and apply rate increases to Arkansas customers. UALR economist Dr. Michael Paco said the decline of nearly 25,000 workers from the state's civilian labor force during the past year may be attributed to discouraged workers no longer looking for jobs, and it could also be part of the expected retirement of the baby boomer generation. For the past 13 months, Arkansas's labor force has experienced a monthly decline in workers. Electronic games of skill wagers at Oaklawn and Southland continued their hot streak in March, as the two casino-style venues set record highs for the second consecutive month. The latest statistics released by the Arkansas Racing Commission showed Oaklawn topping $100 million in electronic games of skill wagers for the first time ever, and Southland's wagers cleared $200 million for the first time ever during the month. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Arkansas Update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from four offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com. It is Monday, April 15th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
It says something very odd about my newsroom, that when something comes up like the name Bam Margera, I'm the one who knows who it is and the one who wants to do the story.
Bam Margera is, for those who don't know.
Can I say that word on the air? He is the one who originated the show Jackass on MTV.
Yeah, you can say that, yeah.
And the Jackass movies.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's spending his money from that because he's made a ton of it. Plus, he was a skateboarder, championship
right.
skateboarder, on supporting metal music.
Mm.
I endorse this idea.
Okay.
And now he's fronting his own metal tour.
And it's coming here?
And it's coming to George's tonight
at
8 o'clock. I will promise you, okay, I can't say the name of the tour on the air.
Okay.
I can't say the name of the most popular song on
okay.
the air.
Okay.
I can't even say parts of the names.
Okay, all right.
So I promise you that if you do not like the language that is often associated with metal music, you should not go to this show.
So warned.
But if you'd like to go see him, and he has a decent voice. Mm-hmm. He really does. He does some metal from other countries and some rap, mm-hmm. including the song that we can't say any of the title of. Mm-hmm. And yeah,
okay.
It'll be an interesting experience, and it's $20. What better way to mark the end of tax day?
Tonight at George's at 8 o'clock. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Nurse Charlie Cullen worked in 8 hospitals and killed dozens of patients before being arrested in 2003. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Charles Graber, author of The Good Nurse, a true story of medicine, madness, and murder, explains how Cullen was able to evade detection for 10 years. Join us.
Fresh Air, tonight beginning at 6 on KUAF. Theater Squared concludes its 7th season with Next to Normal, April 18th through May 12th at Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studios. This contemporary Broadway musical, performed in the intimate studio theater, features a modern family fighting to take care of themselves and each other. Tickets and more information for Next to Normal are available at theater2.org or 443-5600. Support for Ozarks at Large comes, in part, from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle. Local runners did a fine job representing the region in yesterday's Hogeye Marathon in Fayetteville. Brian Hurley of Fayetteville finished second overall, just behind Tim Richard of North Little Rock. Richard won the race in 2 hours, 38 minutes, and 5 seconds. Brian Hurley was in second, finishing 17 seconds behind. Tiffany Relarsik of Fayetteville was the first woman to cross the marathon finish line, completing the 26.2-mile run in just over 3 hours and 12 minutes. Brad Pillsbury of Fayetteville won the half marathon, and Jamie Rogers of Fort Smith was the top female finisher for the half. There will be more running later this month when the 15th annual Ozark Komen Race for the Cure sends thousands of people around the Pinnacle Hills Promenade Mall in Rogers. That takes place on Saturday, the 27th. Already, nearly 6,000 participants have registered. Lauren Marquette, the director of Mission Services for Komen Ozark, says there have been changes for the event since it began 15 years ago.
We started at the Northwest Arkansas Mall. And so now we've really just outgrown that area and had to go to the Pinnacle Hills Promenade Mall. And we're very thankful for the City of Rogers and everything that, you know, the police officers and stuff do. And we've got a 10K now. That was different. It used to just be, you know, 5K walk. And we also have competitive 5K. We have Kids for the Cure area. We've got Bark for the Cure now.
Bark for the Cure? So dogs?
Yes. And it's my favorite part of the race. I mean, before I started working at Komen, I would always bring my dogs there every year. So much stuff. Sleeping for the Cure. You don't have to show up. You sign up.
Yeah.
They mail you your shirt. It's perfect.
Yes. How many people do you expect?
That's a good question.
It seems like every year there are more people.
Yeah. Last year we had a little over 12,000, and we would love to, you know, increase that as much as we can, because the more people we have and the more money's raised, the more we can give out locally. So, and that's one big thing, is that in the 15 years that we've been here, we've given out over $8 million to local organizations. So that's, you know, local women, but families being helped by this money. So
$8 million.
And we've given over $2 million for research. So there's a lot. There has been some research money come back into Arkansas through UAMS, and just finding a cure for, and it's also like different treatments and what treatment responds to what. So it's kind of the gamut of, you know, different research protocols. So
how will the promenade be set up? I mean, where's the course? Where are the dogs?
Yeah.
Never the twain shall meet, perhaps?
Yes, good question. We try to keep, you know, them off their little area. But the morning of, we'll have a survivor breakfast, and that's going to be in the food court. And the race and everything is kicked off. The 5K race is kicked off with the survivor parade going up to the stage. The starting line for the 10K, the 5K, it will all be kind of right around that back parking lot of the food court where it was last year. The course hasn't changed. The BART for the Cure course is going to be in front of PetSmart. And the course has changed because we heard from a lot of people they wanted a longer walk with their dogs. So that course has changed a little bit. And there's a lot of fun new things at BART for the Cure, too. They're going to have a dog photo booth, which I think is hilarious. And they're going to have, I think, some agility drills that they're going to be doing beforehand. But then the Kids for the Cure area is in the middle of the concourse, and then all the vendors will be right in the middle.
5Ks and 10Ks are generally on Saturday mornings, and there's kind of an upbeat atmosphere anyway. But this one seems to have times five.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's funny because every year I go in, I'm not a crier at all. Like, I'm not a big crier person. But we go in and you just see all these amazing survivors and you hear their stories and you see pictures of people that have been lost to breast cancer and, you know, someone's mother or someone's grandmother or sister. And it's just, you know, it's very bittersweet. It's you're so amazed by these women who are walking and strong and are survivors, and you know they've just finished treatment or they're still in treatment, and it's a very hopeful. It's one of the most hopeful times I think in Northwest Arkansas, because we come together to work on helping women, making sure they're getting breast health services, and also finding a cure. That we're hopeful that that's going to happen with our participation, our monies.
How many volunteers do you have?
We have, you know, the University of Arkansas Volunteer Action Center. They actually plan all of our volunteers. And so if anyone's interested in volunteering, you can go to their website. And we have, off the top of my head, we probably have 300 plus volunteers. And, you know, this event pretty much is solely run on volunteers. Yeah. You know, it's a race chair, race course director, race ops. All of our chairs for everything are just volunteers who love our mission and have gotten involved. So it's pretty much, I mean, us as staff give a little bit of support, but it's pretty much a volunteer-run organization. So
I have not been to all 15. Sometimes I'm out of town. But the ones I've been to have had sparkling weather.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been the case most of the years?
For the most part, yeah. And this year it will be. It's going to be beautiful. I'm going on the record now saying that.
What's the t-shirt look like this year?
It's really cute. It has and the word inspire up front. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to be telling you all this, so this is breaking news.
Okay.
I'm sure it's fine. But that's what they get for putting me on the radio. But it says inspire on the front, and it's kind of got pink swirlies, and so you know it's all pink all the time here at Komen. So I even wore pink pants today.
It's
radio, you can't tell, but
well, Laura Marquette is an expert weather predictor and lousy t-shirt secret keeper.
I am.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lauren Marquette is the director of mission services with the Komen Ozark office. You can learn more about the upcoming Race for the Cure, the 15th annual, on April 27th at KomenOzark.org. You can also find them on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. This is Ozarks at Large. Most lists of influential American guitarists from the early part of the last century include Charlie Patton, Robert Johnson, and Charlie Christian. Here's a suggested addition, Frank Hutchison. Gloria Goodwin-Rehasia makes that case convincingly. She's a professor of anthropology at the University of Minnesota, and she spoke on the University of Arkansas campus earlier this spring. Her research and upcoming book, Logan County Blues, Frank Hutchison in the Sonic Landscape of the Appalachian Coalfields, explores his music and the injustices committed by the coal mining companies against coal miners and how miners fought against those companies through their music. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas spoke with her while she was in the area and began by asking her how she chose this particular location in West Virginia, Logan County.
It was the place where the first white man to record a guitar blues, you know, recorded that. And it sounds so much like African-American music. And he learned that from coal miners and railroad workers there. So, and then friends of his, too, recorded. And so it's almost as if they breathed in the blues aesthetic and used it to, in some cases, comment critically on their situation as coal miners,
okay,
in the way that African Americans comment critically on racial hierarchies in blues so often, you know. And it's also the scene of this country's most violent labor uprising in 1920, the Battle of Blair Mountain.
when the Industrial Revolution came to this area? I mean, what was that process like? How long did it take for, did it just happen all at once? You know, was it a very quick change?
Well, maybe, you don't want to say the Industrial Revolution, okay, because there were things happening,
right,
in terms of that earlier. But in terms of the coming of coal mines, railroads, and this was the form in which large-scale corporate, industrial capitalism came. In Logan County, West Virginia, the railroad came in there in 1905, and it came in basically because people wanted to have ways to transport the coal out. And then the coal mines came within just a year or two after that.
Okay.
And one of the most significant kinds of transformations was that the coal companies wanted to buy land. And they would come in and basically trick farmers into signing away the rights to the land. So many people lost their livelihood, they lost their land, and they ended up, of course, as coal miners. So they had this labor supply because
they were no longer farmers.
So, and it was really a horrible regime for those coal miners, because they would, in Logan County and in many parts of Appalachia, the coal companies did not want unionization to happen. So they employed what the miners always called gun thugs, mine guards, armed mine guards, they called them coal camps. These were company towns. The companies owned all the housing. They owned the store. They owned the church. They owned the school. And so they would only bring in teachers and ministers, preachers, who would
teach them what they wanted them to
that the company was like God, and the unions were the work of the devil. So many transformations happened. I mean, the whole way of life of people was transformed at that time. And I'm interested in the way the music registers all of this kind of transformation,
Well, and so the music. I mean, it's not like the Seven Dwarfs singing, hi-ho, I'm off to work.
No, yeah, not exactly.
Right.
Work on no tipple, ain't gonna lay no track. Ain't gonna work on no tipple, ain't gonna lay no track. Gonna hang around my shanty, do the ball and jack.
Almost uniquely in the coal fields, I think, white coal miners who were musicians, played banjo or guitar, adapted this blues idiom and other forms of African-American music. And white musicians in the 1920s, early 1930s played blues in other places in Appalachia in the South, but it was almost in a jokey way, almost mocking it. Well, it's popular, but, we're going to make a joke out of it. Or they would signal their own whiteness. So mm-hmm. they're signaling to the listener, I'm white, but I'll play this
right.
African-American song for you. That kind of thing, these markers of whiteness, didn't happen in the coal fields. They sang them. They wrote things like the miner's blues. Used the blues in ways that African-Americans did, and that African-American musicians or folks who heard it in the 1930s often thought they were black. So it was I hate that word, authentic, but there was a kind of genuine use of that in a way that the African-American musicians used it. And that's kind of unique in the coal fields. But that happened because in the coal fields, unlike other parts of the South, whites and blacks worked together much earlier than in other places. So there was a lot of opportunity for musical exchange, and people did that. So it's a kind of unique sonic landscape in that way, I think. I think it's different from any other place in the South, where we study vernacular music. So both black and white miners wrote these union songs based on African American spirituals. They also wrote them based on hymns that were current in the more in the sort of white mm-hmm. tradition. Write lyrics to that were not based on hymn lyrics or spiritual lyrics, but described heaven in the terms of, for there'll be a union in heaven, you know. Or
because they wanted to unionize.
They wanted to unionize. Right. And so they were envisioning heaven, not literally thinking there could be a union in heaven, but thinking of heaven as the kind of place where there would be a union. There wouldn't be any scabs, mm-hmm. you know, and the bosses wouldn't be there either, you know. And it's interesting to me because Coalfields, there were these preachers hired by the
right.
By the coal companies to preach this gospel of the coal companies, right? But the coal miners didn't want to go there, and they often refused to go. And if they did go, they'd like gamble and drink in the church to express their opinion of what they thought of that
their
message, right?
Or, yeah.
And then lots of miners became informal. You know, they weren't trained or ordained or anything, but they became, they called them minor preachers. Lots of them wrote these songs, and then the songs circulated throughout the coal fields because we have different recordings of mm-hmm. similar ones in different, you know, wildly different places. And it, you know, it interests me that this difference between the and the other interesting thing is that in the Piedmont textile mill areas, workers there would strike for the right to demand that African Americans not be employed in the textile mills along with the whites. That never happened in the coal fields mm-hmm. they worked with. And so you
and
get a whole different
yeah.
musical landscape there. Apart from the strikes and the unions, you get a different musical landscape than you do in the coal fields. So to me, it's just a really interesting set of questions about, really, it's about culture mm-hmm. for music and social and political, you know, arrangements.
Well, I came across one name, I guess, when I was, you know, trying to research for this interview, although, it's, like I said, it's a very specific topic.
That's
so
right.
There wasn't a lot out there. But Frank Hutchinson was a name that I came
yes,
across
yes.
when I was.
Yes. He was the musician, coal miner that I, that drew me to this. After I got interested in blues, I was teaching a freshman seminar on blues, and I was trying to like keep ahead of the freshmen a little bit when I was first 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I came across his music, and I heard when it stopped me dead in my tracks because I could hear the African-American influence in it. And all I knew that he was a white coal miner in West Virginia in the 1920s, that's all I knew about him. And I was fascinated by that. How, where did he get that, you know, in the mountains of West Virginia? And that was what...
And that's what took you down this path.
That's right.
Okay.
To figure out how could that happen, just in terms of the music. And then the more I learned, you know, all these things that mm-hmm. I've been talking about. So the title of my book that I'm writing actually is Logan County Blues, which is the county I'm interested in. It's the title of a Frank Hutchinson song. It's
okay.
just it's actually just a instrumental. It's not words to it, but Logan County Blues, Frank Hutchinson and the Sonic Landscape of the Appalachian Coalfield. So I'm using it. It's not a biography. I'm an anthropologist. I don't write biographies. But I'm using him as a sort of central figure to tell the tale of the labor struggles and all these other things that I've been talking about in terms of the relationship of all kinds of music to the sonic, to the coming of industrial capitalism there. So he's my guy.
So what happened to Frank Hutchinson?
He was he died in 1945. He left West Virginia in 1942. He worked as a coal miner for many years. You know, I found him in the censuses, and I could track what he was doing. And he worked for many, many years in the mines. But I could see these indications that and from relatives of his that I interviewed, that he was always trying to get out of the mines, you know, and try to make a living by his music, but. You know, it was hard in those days unless you were. I mean, he didn't make it in that sense, and the record companies didn't pay you very much for recording. He recorded 30 songs for OK Records in New York and St. Louis. So he left West Virginia, and he loved it there, but it was he lost everything. It was a long story, but he lost everything he had in 1945 41 or 42 when he moved to Dayton in 1942, and then he died of a liver cancer in 1945. So it's sad. The reason we don't know very much is because he died then. So I've really had to dig.
How much time have you spent there in preparation for this book?
Well, there's not a lot. You know, I'm an anthropologist, mm-hmm. and my usual way, most of my research has been in India, in rural North India. Villages there.
So this is very different.
This is very different. Like I said, Frank Hutchison caught me and he said, "You will do this." And I didn't have any, I just said, "Okay, Frank." You know? I mean, it just grabbed me and I had to do it, you know. This kind of research is different because
it's not that.
I can't do that.
There's nothing to submerge yourself in.
Right. So, so I've spent probably just 2 months in Logan County interviewing people, 2 or 3 months, and then lots of time in archives.
Everybody knows the Chevrolet car. Everybody knows they're the best they are.
Gloria Goodwin-Rahasia is a professor of anthropology at the University of Minnesota. She spoke on the University of Arkansas campus earlier this spring semester. Her upcoming book is titled Logan County Blues, Frank Hutchison in the Sonic Landscape of the Appalachian Coalfields. She says she hopes the book will be published this summer. She's also co-producing 2 CDs connected to Hutchison's music. One, a collection of the recordings he made in Logan County, West Virginia, and the other, a volume of new interpretations of his songs by contemporary artists. She talked with Christina Thomas during her visit to the University of Arkansas.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. Arkansas Samuel Conlon Nancarrow was born October 27, 1912 in Texarkana in Miller County. His mother, Myra Brady, was a pianist. His New York native father, Samuel Charles Nancarrow, was the city's mayor in the late 1920s and an affluent industrialist. Conlon loved music and played the trumpet and scandalized his parents by reading socialist tracts. The younger Nancarrow was thus shipped off to an Illinois military school, but he used the opportunity to study music. Similarly, later, Nancarrow's father sent 15-year-old Conlon to Vanderbilt University in Tennessee to learn engineering, but after a semester, Conlon ended up at Cincinnati College in Ohio, again studying music. Conlon Nancarrow admired Bach and also jazz and blues artists like Earl Hines and Bessie Smith. He continued studying music and composition through the 1930s, including conducting a WPA orchestra during the Great Depression. Nancarrow returned to Arkansas after being wounded in Spain fighting against Franco's fascists. He was later denied a passport in the U.S. for his participation in the Spanish Civil War and subsequently moved to Mexico City in 1940. Nancarrow became a Mexican citizen in 1956. While in Mexico, Conlon Nancarrow began working on the music that would make his name as a composer with a singular vision. Sawyer had long been displeased with the way mere mortals played his intricate music, so Conlon Nancarrow began composing with player pianos in mind. He machine-punched his notes into player piano rolls. Soon, Nancarrow was composing for multiple player pianos, layering his frenzied rhythms and melodies atop one another. He added shellac and strips of tin to his piano hammers to give the notes a crispness amongst the forceful playing.
Let's say you have two times going, two tempi going at the same time. You know, if you have one going and something else and whatever, if you have both at the same, let's say, melodic proportions, it's easier to follow the temporal changes. So in other words, if you know, say one starts off this way, if it's the same melody, you don't have to follow the melody. You're just hearing the temporal relationship. So if it's the same melody going, I mean, it's easier for me. I just have to do it once.
Word began to spread about this composer with the unusual sound and methods. In 1969, Conlon Nancarrow's debut album, Studies for Player Piano, was released on Columbia Records. A better recorded four-volume series for the smaller 1750 Arch Records helped solidify his reputation. In 1977, Nancarrow's scores were published for the first time. He toured Europe and the U.S. in the 1980s, where his complex compositions caused sensations well beyond the classical world. County native was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship in 1982 at age 70. The Paul Soccer Foundation in Switzerland obtained and preserves Nancarrow's piano rolls and manuscripts. Samuel Conlon Nancarrow died August 10, 1997 in Mexico City, Mexico. His centennial was observed in his old hometown of Texarkana in 2012 with Nancarrow's son and widow in attendance. Musicians and the listening public are still catching up with the compositions of Conlon Nancarrow. Here's Arkansas-er Conlon Nancarrow of Texarkana with Prelude for Piano. Arkansas-er Conlon Nancarrow of Texarkana with Prelude for Piano. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of KUAR and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Keith Merks. For more information, go to arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
And this is a Monday edition of Ozarks at Large. Just a bit more music now. Tartuffe is a trio from San Francisco, and the three of them are coming to Nightbird Books in Fayetteville for a performance tomorrow night. Their latest CD is titled These Factory Days. As Ozarks at Large's Katie Hendrickson reports, the trio, made up of Lynn Angel, Brian Gorman, and Ben Thorne, doesn't always do things conventionally.
In their own words, they describe their music as loop-heavy, sonically diverse soundscapes with overlaying harmonies, melodies, and polyrhythms that interweave between the lands of beauty, loss, and triumph. While they're making a stop in Fayetteville, they play Nightbird Books Tuesday night for an all-ages show at 9 p.m. I caught up with the band, all of them actually, as they are touring throughout the United States. When I called them, they were just leaving Cleveland, Ohio. Now, a band is like a family, so anytime you add or take away, it changes the dynamic. The first question I had for Lynn was exactly how adding a third member worked with the group.
I think it's a little bit of a process. It's like Brian and I became really comfortable writing as a duo and, you know, exploring all of the different ways that we could create sound And then it just became a little bit much, I think, at a certain point a couple of years ago. You know, our setup was so huge and we were all playing so many instruments, and like, I just stopped being able to enjoy playing the music. I was just thinking too much about what the next thing was. And at the same time, our friend's band, Low Red Land, was breaking up, and they were good friends of ours, and we toured with them quite a bit. And so we grabbed their bass player, Ben, and sucked him into our band. And, you know, it definitely took a second. It was definitely, it's like adding, you know, adding another person to your relationship. You know, it's just, it's complicated, but I think that, you know, we're still working it out, but I mean, I think it's for the best. I really feel like it's made our band a lot better, so.
Now, Tartuffe tours a lot. They love to perform live. That means they play some songs over and over and over again. That can be a challenge, but for Tartuffe, they make each performance new.
That's been kind of exciting, and I feel like, you know, like whenever we take an older piece, and we always tend to, like, make it different somehow, and whether that's, like, changing the rhythm or, you know, adding a couple different loops on the top, or Ben playing, you know, whatever he's going to play over the top, which is definitely always going to be different from what we've written. It always kind of makes it better and exciting.
Another challenge for touring bands is a way to bring in steady income, because they can't keep a regular 9-to-5 job. Well, Tartuffe came up with a creative solution, and that is they formed a program called Rock Band Land. It's a program that teaches rock and roll to children ages 4 through 8. Brian Gorman tells me more about the project.
It's a creativity / music school for kids ages 4 to 8 years old, where we write all original rock songs and stories with the kids. We produce and record the songs with them, and then we do these kind of huge rock concerts with them at the end of each session. And I started it with Lynn years ago, so that we could, you know, have a freer schedule for touring. At the time I was, you know, losing job after job so that we could just stay on the road, and so this was a way of having something that was our own, that we could control the schedule of, and, you know, and be responsible for our own income with. And it's kind of blown up into, you know, a full-fledged business and a really, you know, awesome endeavor.
Now, the emphasis of Rock Band Land isn't necessarily to create the next generation of rock and roll superstars. It's about empowerment.
The biggest thing that we do, I mean, less than trying to create, like, amazing rock musicians, it's trying to foster the kids, you know, self-esteem and confidence as creative, you know, people. And that, I mean, we see that, you know, time and again from kids who come in who are, you know, like, really shy or have, like, sensory issues, and they come out of our class, like, you know, even just 6 weeks later, and they're, like, you know, they're front and center on the stage, like, screaming into a microphone, and, you know, and they're completely owning a song that they had a hand in writing. So we see that. That's like, a very common thing with our program, just seeing kids who are, you know, on the quieter side come out as, like, these really confident, like, brave little rockers.
That's Brian Gorman of Tartuffe. Earlier, you heard from Lynn Angel. They also play with Ben Thorne, who you did not hear from. I did speak to him, but the connection was not very ideal when I talked to him, so I couldn't use any of that audio, unfortunately. You can catch Tartuffe playing Nightbird Books Tuesday night at 9 p.m. with locals Creep Vibes. The show is all ages, and for more information, you can visit nightbirdbooks.com. They also have a all-ages show Wednesday night worth checking out at 8:30 p.m. featuring weird folk from Molasses Gospel and Romantic Animal, both touring bands, and Fayetteville's own Anything Helps. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
You can learn more about the band, by the way, at tartufferock.net. For Malco movie passes to give away, and 4 vouchers to an upcoming Northwest Arkansas Naturals game. You pick the game. You exchange the vouchers for tickets at the window. The winner is James Strait. James, congratulations. I'll be in touch with you by email in just a few minutes to explain how we'll get those tickets to you. We'll give away another so-called family pack tomorrow on the daily edition of Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Foundation, and support for KUAF comes from Soul Yoga Lounge, offering 26 classes per week, focusing on flexibility, balance, strength, and stress relief. Gift certificates, logo wear, mats, and handmade bags that support the Give Back program Join are available. Located on Dixon Street in Fayetteville and on the web at soulyogalounge.com. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Kingston. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening.